Hello and welcome to Talking Shit About, a monthly podcast where I, Elizabeth Weberman, interview somebody about something they love, something they hate, something they've been through, or something they just know a lot about, and hopefully by the end we've all learned something. For this intro, I'm also joined by my cat Ampersand, who's purring and licking my fingers. Don't worry, he won't be doing that for the interview. This is a great one. I interviewed Charlie Hooper-Williams, who is a musician and does a lot of visuals. It's a super cool interview. I feel differently about algorithms. Well, not totally different, but I have a new perspective added to my, I don't know what you call it. I'm tired. I've had a busy day. I can't talk about it yet, but busy day. Yeah, you know me. I don't like long intros. Let's go ahead and talk some shit.
I was like, what the fuck does that mean? I have friends that are firefighters, and I know that they use soap.
And she was screaming at me over soup.
Fuck this, I am not ever talking to a Scientologist again. These people are all insane.
I'm putting my bricks in the dumpsters, motherfuckers. Do you see me, bitches? I'm throwing my bricks. And he's just like chucking bricks.
Hey, everybody. I'm here with Charlie Hooper-Williams, and we're going to be talking about some classical music. Charlie is a musician, but does a lot more than just make music. So Charlie, I will let you kind of dive into what you do and who you are.
Sure. Hi, thanks for having me on. So like you said, I'm a musician, I'm a pianist and a composer, and I'm also a creative coder. And how that fits in with what I do is I've built a system that listens to what I play and makes visuals in response to it. So if I play a note, you'll see something on the screen. And the couple of things, for sometimes people are sort of like, oh, is it like the old like Windows visualizer or something? and the answer is sort of in that, you know, it is being created by the music, but because it's all stuff I've coded, I have this, I have a lot of control over how the music gets turned into visuals. So for one piece, the names of the notes appear on the screen when I play them. And then there's a line of poetry that uses those letters with that, whatever space there is between the letters, will fade in so that I'm making this poem as I'm playing the music. There's another one where each note has a different color, and there's a grid, a 32 by 32 grid. And as I play every time I play a note, one of the squares lights up. And then when the grid fills up, the piece is done. So there's just, it's like, each piece, I try to think not just about what's happening moment to moment, but also how the entire architecture across the arc of the piece should be visualized. The other thing I guess that I need to say now is that none of it is generative AI. It's all stuff I've, you know, handcrafted artisanal algorithms that I've built. There's no like GPT or you know, Midjourney or anything.
That's very cool. And my brain immediately went to the Windows player. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a bad starting point to think about it, but the Windows Media Player kind of just does the same thing no matter what you play into it. And mm-hmm. This is a bit more like, yeah, like sometimes I'll say inverse film scoring, where like instead of the music supporting the film supports the music. That's a little bit galaxy brain sometimes. So.
And how would you describe your music?
So my music is, how do I describe my music? my music is what I would call post-classical, in that it is influenced by or comes out of a classical music tradition, but it isn't itself classical music, I don't think. There's a whole lot of like, what is that term? When we start getting into like, classical and what is like post-classical or neoclassical, but in broad strokes, it's instrumental piano music that emphasizes connecting with an audience. So when you talk about like new music, new classical music, a lot of that is pretty spiky. It's oftentimes written kind of by specialists for specialists, and this isn't that. This is writing that should, I think, connect with anybody.
And for our listeners, and you might have just defined it honestly, but how would you like briefly describe like classical music? Because I know when I hear classical, I think like Bach, you got some strings, maybe some piano. But I personally don't have like a definition for it. So I was curious if you
Yeah,
have one.
yeah. So this is something I think about a lot because, you know, it is something that comes up, like what makes music classical? And like when we think about classical music, often we think about it as old music. And then we kind of think, well, all the music back then was classical, but we had folk music back then. Everything wasn't concert music. But now we very much have this split between kind of pop music and all the music that's kind of around that, and then classical. And so there's a lot of things where you'd be like, oh, this is something, but then you can find an exception, right? So there's going to be exceptions for all of this. But I think music that comes out of a notated tradition, or if you want to sound really pretentious, a literate tradition, but I don't really like that because it makes the other music sound illiterate rather than non-literate. It's stuff where you write the music down. I have friends who do classical music and they don't, or this kind of post-classical music, and their music isn't written down. So that's not a requirement, but it's that kind of music. It's the kind of music that you might write down a score for as the composition, right? So if I've written a piece of music, it can be on a sheet of paper and I can say that's the music. If you take, I'm just going to say the Beatles because there's actually the published massive thing. I feel like the Beatles are kind of receding from the current point in time substantially now. Could be anybody, whatever. You could take a Dua Lipa song. You could write that down, but that's a transcription. The song, a Dua Lipa song, is not a thing on paper. It's a thing that you, it's like a sound, a recorded sound. And it's not even really what she performs live. When you're talking about pop music, the song is the recording. And you can perform that song live, and live performance is really important in, you know, pretty much every kind of music. But when you think about like what is, if you had to pick one thing that is the song, it's in pop music, it's the audio recording. And in classical music, it is more likely to be the thing that you wrote down on paper. Now, in post-classical, that gets a little bit weird because I think post-classical is essentially that kind of music that's then been moved into a space where the recording kind of starts to be like the primary piece of art that you've made from it. But I think I've delved into that. That's about as far as I can. Like I could go on and on about that, but I think that's a good place to leave it.
Think that's a great definition. Thank you. And how did you get into music? Did you grow up playing the piano?
I grew up playing the piano, and in my later childhood, I also played violin. And then I wanted to play a cool instrument, so I played saxophone. And then I realized saxophone is not necessarily a cool instrument, and I started trying to learn guitar. But by then, it was kind of too late. And yeah, but I did play piano. My parents got a piano when I was probably 3. And then I kind of just messed around with it. I would take the front off and I would bang the strings inside and scrape them and do all this, that kind of stuff. And then it was probably when I was 7 that I started taking lessons. And I wasn't a super serious piano student. Like it was always kind of my thing. But I didn't like really apply myself until later on when I kind of, I decided I'd like to do something with this, and then realized like, oh, that actually takes a lot of work. And so I started practicing a ton to try to get into music school, which I then did. I did classical for undergrad, which I always felt a little bit on the outside of. I turned up at Northwestern, and I was with, there were kids there who had done like Juilliard pre-college. You know, they had been in such a, you know, kind of hothouse environment for being like a brilliant Mozart interpreter or really knowing all the repertoire. And I just felt like I'd walked in off the farm and just had no idea what was going on. And I think that's part of how I got into new music, because that was a territory where I felt like I could develop some authority without having like this kind of upbringing inside the tradition. Now, I think some of that in retrospect was just my own issues. I think there's also something like I was never going to be like a world-class Mozart interpreter. That's just not in me. Like I love Mozart, I'll play it, but like I'm not going to get signed to like Sony Classical to like record the Mozart sonatas. That is not my thing. But what I did like doing is finding new pieces of music that maybe weren't as well known and bringing those in. So there's a composer called Frederick Shevsky, and I played one of his pieces at a competition in Russia. And that was really, I think, a lot of times, again, like we talked about, people think about new music as being kind of spiky and difficult. And that's a piece that is very much in a 20th century idiom, but is super fun to listen to. It's super rhythmic. It's like splashy and, just fantastic. And so it can be really fun. You don't have to kind of know about classical music, in quotes, to understand or appreciate it. It's just fun. And I found I really enjoyed that. But then, yeah, after a while, I kind of, a lot of the spikiness of new music, I felt like was a problem for new music and for people loving new music who weren't like deep inside this world of new music. And so I stepped away from that. And that was the beginning of me kind of moving into what I'm doing now.
Can you describe a little bit what you mean by spikiness?
Yeah, so there's an emphasis on experimentation in a surface level that I think comes from your kind of like early to mid 20th century time period. There were a few things going on. There was like Schoenberg, Emancipation of the Dissonance stuff, which if you haven't heard of, is like it basically just you can write music to be as dissonant as you want, and writing music with like no tonal center, which is interesting for a bit, but there's a kind of championing of that as the way to write music, that being sort of better, because you can make really complex systems with it. And then the second part was after the Second World War, everyone was like, the world is horrible. This has been this really terrible thing. We can't write music that sounds nice after something like that. We have to write music that expresses the horrors of war. But then that kind of just got baked into academia, and that became how music sounds. And so there's this feeling that music that sounds nice is kind of lesser. And until pretty recently, that you hear people in the kind of new music scene really kind of snobbishly saying, oh, that sounds like film music if you wrote something that had a tune or that, was in a key. And I think that's really changed in the last 10 years or so. There's much more of a, you can just write what you want. And if it sounds pleasant, then great. And if you want to write something that is really out there and, more kind of challenging to listen to, then there's going to be some kind of an audience for that. But yeah, it's a lot of the spikiness is this, writing things that don't really have identifiable melodies or key centers and that really use a lot of rough and difficult sonorities in the music. And I think often that's done in the name of kind of experimentalism and pushing the envelope. But when I hear a lot of this music, it sounds like music that could have been written 50 years ago. And I don't buy that that's forward-looking at all anymore. I don't think there's anything, like progressive or forward-looking about difficult music.
As you were talking about it, I was thinking back. My brother used to play in like a harsh noise band. So it was like oil drums and chains and like all sorts of stuff. Yeah, difficult for some people to listen to for sure. I don't think that's what you were specifically talking about, but.
No, but I actually that's a really good point of contrast because that kind of music is designed to give you a pretty extreme emotional reaction, right? It's very engaging emotionally. And it's not something people will always want. There's going to be a lot of people who don't want that. And that's probably part of why people who are really into that music are into it. Some of it is just enjoying the emotion that comes from it. Some of it is probably enjoying that other people don't like it. But it is entertaining. And I think that there's. I think when people are writing music in like a noise genre, if it's within a scene, then like that scene is kind of self-referencing and self-supporting. And I guess what I don't want to sound like a massive capitalist here, but one of the problems I think with the new music side of things is that so much of it is institutionally supported. Is that you don't just have this scene of people writing music because they love it. You have a bunch of people with like tenure or funding writing music that maybe they love, but that is kind of put in this position over other music. I feel like I'm being kind of negative about it now. I think if you love that kind of music, amazing, go write it. But I guess I came up in the system where that was really foregrounded. And I guess I'm just sort of explaining why I feel like we should move past that. And yeah, just let things be genreized. So if you are into that, great. But like, there's, nobody's going to be like, oh my God, you don't like that noise band. Like, you like reggae. Like, it's just, you like reggae. That's cool. Okay, I like this noise band. Like, there's nobody thinks like that one's more important than the other one.
Yeah. So what genres or artists and stuff did you listen to growing up? Like any of that kind of inspired your music?
Yeah, I had a really weird relationship with pop culture where I missed out on a lot of big touchstones. Like I didn't hear Paul Simon's Graceland until like 10 years ago. And that's a big album that I feel like everybody should have heard. It somehow just didn't it did not cross my radar when I was sitting there in the practice room. So yeah, there's I mean I did as a kid, I listened to Red Hot Chili Peppers and They Might Be Giants and a lot of bands from obviously Radiohead, and I think those things do anything you listen to it's in you, it becomes part of how you experience music. These days, I'm listening to a lot of artists like Hani Arani, who's a Polish composer who's just fantastic. She's got a new piano concerto that I'm very excited to hear. Poppy Aykroyd is a British composer who's just doing amazing work. There's people like Nils Frahm, Olafur Arnalds. So yeah, there's this like kind of coterie of pianists doing this kind of thing. And yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot. I think there's going to kind of more like classic touchstones, things like Keith Jarrett. When I first heard him, it just blew my mind. It was like, wow, you can do that with a piano. So yeah.
I'm not gonna play the "Have you heard of this band" game because like classical is so not my genre. But I did think of Anna von Haswolf as you were talking. Have you listened to any of her work?
No, but I should.
She plays the organ and she has amazing pipes. It's very like ethereal, kind of spooky. I've heard it described as doom pop. I think it's dismissive, like women. It's more doom metal, but I can also see why people call it doom pop. I don't get too into genres, but
Okay.
that's probably like the
I
closest thing that I listen to.
Okay, nice. I'll check it out.
Right, my cat just got off my notes, so now I can look at my notes again. So you are a coder in addition to, I don't know if anyone uses that word, but do coding, I guess, in addition to
Yeah,
music.
coder is fine. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, am I a coder? Am I a developer? Am I a software engineer? I don't know. Yeah, I
Depends
do. I
on the
make
job
stuff
you're
with
applying
code.
for.
Yeah.
So one thing we had mentioned when we were chatting before before we scheduled the interview and stuff was algorithms and the role that they're playing right now in how we're interacting
Yes.
with music. Would you like to dive into that?
Yeah. I mean, people talk about the algorithm, right? Like, oh, you got to put a face in your post because of the algorithm, or like, oh, my playlists are all like, the algorithm just keeps playing me. Like, I saw somebody posted, like, the Spotify algorithm seems to be incapable of recommending me any music that I haven't already listened to, which is a thing that I have also found. It just feels like so much of our life is based around algorithms. If you're trying to buy something, algorithms are trying to change how we vote, or what, just everything about what we do. And I think, well, we're in a period of transition, right? Where this is all pretty new. We're figuring out, like, can we control this? How can we work within this? How can we kind of defend against some of this algorithmic behavior? But one of the things that I think about as a, I guess, as a developer and an artist is that the algorithm or algorithms themselves are just tools. They're neutral. So you can do good things or bad things with them. And part of how I see my art is using algorithms to be creative, to make an artistic experience that people can enjoy. because that's another thing algorithms can do. And I guess I kind of want them to not get a bad rap. Like, algorithms do all sorts of amazing things. Sometimes they do bad stuff because people program them that way, but they can also do really nice things if people program them that way. So if we want to change what we're doing, it's not so much get rid of the algorithms, but let's change the algorithms. Let's use them in a way. Use these tools well to make a better life for us.
Are there any platforms that you gravitate towards, whether that be for finding new music, sharing music, or general doom scrolling?
Yeah, so Bandcamp is and has been for a while kind of the main place where independent artists can sell their stuff, where you can discover things that are, outside of the mainstream and just actually support artists if you buy stuff. So it's just kind of a digital storefront for artists. I like sending people there. I get really happy whenever I get a little ping someone's bought something from me there. And I try to buy stuff from there whenever I can. I try to not spend any more time on Spotify than I have to. Spotify is market dominant, and they're not kind of uniquely bad in terms of shady behavior, but as the market leader, they kind of, have the most possibility to move things in one way or another. And so I feel like it makes sense to put the most pressure on them to try to give artists a fairer shake. Because as I'm sure you're aware, I'm sure your listeners are aware, you don't really make money when people listen to your stuff on Spotify. So there's a campaign in the UK that's a penny per stream, which is to get artists to get paid 1 penny per stream, and that is like 100 times what is happening right now. Now, I understand market economy stuff well enough to know that you can't just sort of magic money up out of nowhere, but the way that it's working right now with Spotify is that major labels are guaranteed higher payouts and independent artists end up getting paid less. So I think there is some room in there to pay independent artists more fairly. I will say that the 1,000 stream cliff that they put in sounds scary, but it's actually, I think, fine. I
What is
understand that
that?
they put, so they demonetize streams until you get to 1,000. This was like a big thing that artists were talking about. And in a vacuum, it's like, well, yeah, no, if my song gets like 900 streams, I want to get paid for those. I don't want to not get paid anything until, I reach this cliff. But because you can just put stuff on Spotify for free now and you can automate things, you can just write a script to make 1 million songs a day and put them all on Spotify. And then if one of them accidentally gets played, then you would get a small amount of money, right? Like it's still small, but if you can do it in bulk enough, people were trying to flood the market and try to make some money that way, not through any kind of artistic value, but just through having so many songs on Spotify that they couldn't help but get some plays. Spotify, of course, does need to defend against that, and I think they should. And enforcing this cap, I think, is a reasonable way to do it. I don't love it, but in that context, I think it makes sense. And one of the key things that did I keep in mind is it's not that you only get paid for your like 1,001st stream. Once you hit 1,000 streams, you get paid for all 1,000 streams. So for a smaller artist, that might not happen like on the day that the song releases. You might have some like deep cuts that take a while to get there. But if you have people actually listening to your music, you should get to that point eventually and get paid out. Even though you're not getting paid out what I think probably streams should get paid at, you are still getting paid that amount. So kind of a tangent, but I think that's worth knowing about. It was a big deal for a bit when that change happened earlier this year. In
Absolutely.
terms of other platforms, I spend too much time on TikTok. It changed something changed about a year or so ago in the algorithm, and it was different, but it's still. I mean, I say I spend too much time, but it's not actually that much time. I'll go on there like once a week, and I feel like that's seldom enough that I get some gold. It's not doom scrolling. I'm getting like whatever the best things are the algorithm has for me, and I like that it's weird. I mean, that's an example of algorithms doing something interesting. That the difference with that, as a software developer, I loved, is the first user experience, right? You've downloaded the app, you've downloaded TikTok, you've never used it before, you launch it. And in most apps, it's like, welcome to this app, please sign up, right? And no, that's nobody wants to do that. TikTok, you open it for the first time and it's like, here's a video. You don't have to make an account, you don't have to do anything, just hear the video, right? You scroll, here's a different video, and it just figures out what you want. And so that I really enjoy, because it lets you just discover things you might not otherwise like. You know, if you go in and you say, oh yes, I like this and this and this, that's your kind of stated preference, and you have this whole opportunity for revealed preference, which is not always what you think you might want to watch. There was a period where it was showing me like demolition videos for a while, because the first few were like, yeah, like knock down that skyscraper, like not like violent ones. This is like, you know, controlled demolition, but it was really interesting for like, I don't know, 10. And then I had to be like, no, this is, you know, this is not my special interest. Because it does do that, where it, like, you start watching something and it's like, oh, this is the only thing you want to see.
Yes.
No. So anyway, yeah, TikTok. I mean, we've all been there.
I just got a TikTok a few months ago. I was specifically to promote the podcast. It's hit or miss. Usually when I post about the podcast, I don't get any sort of engagement or views, but then I post like something stupid or my dogs and then I get more. So that's fine.
I've found the same. Yeah, I don't really, I had a go at it for a little bit of trying to post on TikTok, and it just, yeah, it's, I think it has to be a full, you really have to go full time on it and just be so into it, or just be along for the ride. And that's what I'm doing now.
Yeah, I was doing pretty good until I posted a video about Antifa. And then it kind of went down and got zero views from there.
Oh, did you get anyways, shadow banned?
Maybe, I'm not sure. I'm not too worried about it, honestly. I was scrolling for a while, but the algorithm cannot figure me out. Like when I first started, it was really cool animation and I was all about it and like people's music. And then like you said, I think I watched one of those videos it just randomly recommended, and it was like somebody like, this is how you beat the algorithms, this is how you get out of 300 view jail. And then that was all the videos I was getting recommended.
Oh yeah, and yeah. So yeah, like, long press, not interested is like the pro tip for TikTok. I had to do it a lot. I was getting those all the time. It's like, yeah, once you've posted something, it's like, oh, this show them this now.
So kind of going back to the algorithm, I don't know if this is a good question, but do you feel that the way we discover music or interacted with music or interact with music has sort of changed since like streaming became so like?
Oh yeah, mainstream? It's absolutely changed it. Yeah. The switch to playlisting and algorithmic discovery has just broken all our brains for like seeking out music. I think the biggest thing is that it has kind of killed the blogosphere, if that's a word still. All the music blogs that I used to look at or like send stuff to when I would release music are either pared way back or just not existing anymore, because everybody just discovers stuff algorithmically. So why would you go read a cool music blog that would tell you what's coming up? And I think that's like, I think we got out of the habit of the social aspect of music. Like people don't send me stuff as much as they used to, being like, oh, I heard this, you should listen to this. Like I try to send stuff to friends, but like it's just this, that whole thing that I feel like used to just be part of your daily life. It's like you discover, even if when you discover something, I feel like everybody's like, oh, well, my friends are going to hear it too, because it's just out there. And it's like, well, no, they might not. That you got to tell them, you know?
Yeah, I think the most in tune I was ever with like music, I was working at a college radio station, and like you weren't supposed to play top 40. So you had to go out of your way to look for artists. And we would get mailed CDs, you know, from artists, which was cool to be able to like, you know, find all this new music. But now that I'm not in that position anymore, yeah, I'm kind of, I wish I didn't use Spotify. I do. I need to pick up Bandcamp more. Also, just a PSA.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, just, I mean, yeah, people, you know, like I switched to Apple Music, but it's, yeah, I don't blame people for listening to stuff on Spotify. I actually have people at shows, they'll buy my CD and they'll be like, I don't have a CD player. I'm not going to listen to this, but I won't feel guilty now when I listen to you on Spotify. And I fully support that. Like, if you've listened to something, well, I mean, not just, I'm not saying like do this with, I mean, do this if you want to with my music, but like anybody, if you have listened to someone's music on Spotify and you love it and it's really like helped you in some way, just like go buy something from them. Like, it's, you know, if they're a small artist, like if it's, I'm not saying don't support like the Taylor Swifts of the world, but I feel like they can get away with, you can, you know, you can get away with Spotifying the like major names. But when it's like someone small, like it really matters every single time. 'Cause you know, I'm not getting like thousands and thousands of orders here. You know, it's like when every time somebody gets a thing, like I put the CD in the mail, or the record or the, you know, poster or whatever it is. And it's fun. It like makes my day every time.
Yeah, and
So
it's fun to
anyway.
collect stuff. Yeah, I do that with vinyl. Like my record player broke a few years ago, but I'm still buying vinyls, especially if they release one that's like a pretty color. And Bandcamp is great because is it the first Friday that they do Bandcamp Fridays?
Yes. They announce it semi-randomly. They'll just be like, this Friday will be Bandcamp Friday.
Awesome. And for our listeners, that means on that day, all the money that you pay will go directly to the artist, because normally some of it goes to Bandcamp.
Yep. Yeah, they take a revenue share, which again is fine. They are running this platform, but it's really cool that they have these days where they don't do that. They waive it, and all the money goes to the artists. And it's a great excuse to get on there and buy some stuff.
Yeah. Was there anything related to like the algorithm that you really wanted to talk about that we kind of glossed over?
I think the only other thing with the algorithm really is that having stats for everything has pushed everyone even more than it was before into this thing that, you know, if you don't have a million followers, then you don't exist. Or if you don't have, you know, 500,000 monthly listeners, you don't exist. Or, you know, all these things of that you kind of have to be in this like world dominating position for it to be real. And I don't buy that. And I don't think that buying that is helpful for us as humans. I think you have to like remember that we live in villages, or you know, even if you live in a big city, you have your like village within the city. And before any of this, like you could be a big deal in your town or your state or whatever. And that was actually, that existed. That was a real thing. And now it's like you're just on this list with everybody else in the whole world. And so if you're not, you know, number one or number seven or whatever in the world, it's like, who even cares? And I think that is not a good attitude to have. So I am saying this largely to myself. I have to remind myself of that, but I think for other creatives, but also for people consuming music, often somebody will like this artist, and this artist might have 100,000 fans around the world, which is a massive number of people. That isn't enough for them to be like a major global artist, but that's a ton of people. That's probably a really good artist, right? Like, that's, you know, so I think, yeah, just like, and I suppose backing up a step from that is just like believe in your own taste. Like, if you find something and you love it, it doesn't matter if you're the first person to ever stream that album. Just, it's great. You've found this thing, and it might get a bajillion views or follows or listens or whatever someday, but it might not. Like, there are things that there's this like Swedish string trio that I listen to in university, and they like don't exist on the internet. I've found been able to find out very little about them, but I love their music. I'm considering buying one of their, so you can get their CDs like collector type thing. Like, there's a few of them online, and I think I might pay like $45 for a CD from them because I just want to hear it again, and you can't get it on streaming.
What would you like to see for like the future of music is very broad. But I guess as like a creative, how would you like, is there kind of like a perfect system that you can envision?
Perfect system. I mean, perfect systems have a way of going really wrong, you know. But I think I so there's a th so I live in the UK and I'm from the States, so I kind of have a sense of how like art ecologies work in both places. One thing I really value about the UK is that you can get funding as an individual artist. So in the States, we used to have that. We killed it off in, I think, I want to say the 80s because of Piss Christ. You can censor that if you need to. That's a whole backstory. You can look it up if you need to. But the NEA basically just said, we don't want controversy, so we're only going to fund institutions who can then give out money to individuals. And so you've got this extra layer, and there isn't one central point. Here we have Arts Council England for England. There's the other nations have their own Arts Council things, but you can apply and you can say, hi, I have this project, I want to do this thing, and they'll just give you money to do it. I make that sound simple. It's actually a massive pain in the ass to apply. I think they should make that more streamlined, but I'm so glad that it exists. One thing, though, that I think would be good to separate out is that they put a lot of emphasis on social impact. And I think that it's important to fund people to go into schools and to work with, underserved communities and all these kind of outreach, music is social work kind of stuff. I think that should definitely be funded, but I don't think funding art for art's sake, the people that you would fund just to go make some great art are not necessarily the best people to go do that outreach work. And right now it's all rolled into one. So I think separating those things out would be good for any system. I think, in the States you have, there's a system of kind of private philanthropy that does a lot of similar stuff. And I guess with private philanthropy, you have more opportunity to fund those strands separately. But I think, yeah, art for change and also art for art, we need to have support for both of those. I think recognizing that you do need to keep fertilizing the garden in order to keep getting things out of it. If you want new, exciting pieces of art or artists or anything like that, you've got this really long time period where you need to fund people taking risks and doing different stuff. I'm not going to be down on like massive pop icons or anything, but I don't think all music should sound like that. I think having like weirder music that can be sustainable for people is important. So I think having more of a culture, I would love to have more of a culture of benefactors. I mean, that has its own whole like weird power stuff with it, but I think you can get a lot from, there's just so many people with money. I mean, especially in the States, who could just be like, oh yeah, I'll give you 10 grand a year. That's nothing. I make 700 grand a year because I work at Google. And you can, have a day off a week to do more art because I love your band. Oh, here, my other friends did that. Now you don't have to have a day job. You can just have your, because we love your band that much, we're going to do that. It's just sort of a weird thing that I don't think people do that much, but I think that'd be amazing if more people did that. Yeah, and I think we do need to sort out, like, how do you make a living as a musician? It's never something that's just going to be easy, but I think we are at a point where, I mean, I never could have done anything that I did if I didn't get into tech. Not because I made a, bajillion and I'm like retired now, but I'm able to do small amounts of software contracting to keep things going when I don't have as many gigs, if I'm going to record. And then when I have a lot of gigs, I can dial that back down. So that kind of flexibility, I am hugely grateful to have. But if I didn't have that, I wouldn't be able to do this. And so I think having more systems where people can get that kind of flexibility and support would really help other people take a step into doing more with their creative ideas.
I think those are all really great ideas. We talked a little bit about your music at the top, but could you kind of do a little recap? Tell us what your music is, where they can find it, and any like projects that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, so to describe the music just in a more concrete way, because I think I went kind of galaxy brain at the top. I'm a pianist. It's piano music. On this album that is just out, I also have some strings. I have some kind of subtle electronics, and that's kind of the sound world that I'm operating in. The album that is out on November 5th which is probably in the past by the time you're listening to this, but the recent past, and you should, it's a very fresh music still. You should go listen to it right now. It's called The Book of Fixed Stars, and it is my first album that I'm putting out on an actual proper record label. This label called The Way Beyond Music approached me after a single I put out, and it's been great working with them. We did an EP at the beginning of the year, and then this full album is the first full album we're putting out together. Because of that, we have vinyl. You like a colored vinyl? This
Ooh.
is a transparent vinyl. It
Ooh.
looks so good. I'm trying to figure out how to take pictures of it so you can actually see how nice it looks. But that's just a lovely thing to hold and to have and to listen to. There's also CDs because, of course, everybody definitely still listens to those. And the other two things that I guess I should mention are I have sheet music because I write everything. I compose by writing stuff down because I have the memory of a goldfish and I would forget everything immediately if I didn't write it down. It's pretty easy for me then to say, oh, this is 20 pieces for piano. I will publish them. So you can get that if you play the piano or if you know someone who plays piano. That is available on Bandcamp as well. And I've just started doing a plotter prints, so like a pen plotter where it's like a robot that holds the pen and draws for you. So each one is made individually and they're made with code that is the same sort of system that I use to make my visuals. So if you want something visual that is individually made, those are on Bandcamp too. And yeah, I'm touring around. I might be touring in the US, but probably not for. Yeah, the probably it's probably 2027 at this point. But there's a couple of places that have that we're in touch with in the States trying to figure out how to make a tour happen over there because it's I have a lot of stuff. It's not just sort of putting a guitar on an airplane. It's, you know, either flying my piano or hiring a piano that has MIDI switches in the keys over there and moving it around to the venues. And I have these light towers that are these like pixel tower things that are like a custom build. So like I'd have to, you know, and
Oh, that's
they're
cool.
super fun. I love having them in the show, but it's like bringing those. Anyway, I hope to tour the US, but if you're listening from the UK, come to a show here or, you know, I'm on Instagram. I didn't even mention Instagram. I just assumed that was kind of taken for granted when we were talking about platforms. That is actually where I do most of my posting, when I am
And do you
posting.
share those visuals that you make on Instagram?
Yes. Yeah,
Awesome.
so we'll put snippets on there. I'll put some live concert snippets. I'm working on recording more of the visuals to put on YouTube. There is some of them are on YouTube and I'll be continuing to post more, so you can subscribe there if you want to see those.
Well, Charlie, thank you so much. This was a great conversation. I know I've learned a lot. Were there any other pluggables or anything that we missed?
I
I'll
think,
have
yeah,
links to everything in the show notes for sure.
the album's the big thing. That's like why this media push thing is happening now. So, yeah, that's the big one. There will be more, you know, there's another album that will come out eventually and stuff like that, but
Awesome.
we'll chat about that when that happens, maybe.
Heck yeah. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you.
That is a wrap for this month's episode of Talking Shit About. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a microsode, and then back in April with another interview. And this is from the perspective of somebody who works in a state psychiatric hospital. Super interesting conversation, so I'm excited for you to listen to that one too. Don't forget to check out all of Charlie's stuff and also my stuff. In the show notes, there is a link to my Linktree, which has a link to my new zine that I made. Super trans femme positive resources, etc., etc. It's called Protect the Dolls. I also have my merch shop, which is open, and some of the proceeds go to Tillamook County Food Banks. So be sure to check that out, get some merch. And you can join me on Patreon for $2 a month, where you get early access and exclusive content. And let's see what else. You can follow me on social media. I haven't been super active lately, but that's just the way it goes when you work full time and you have a podcast hobby. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you soon.